Today on Wings, the Mother of Motherhood Studies.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Dr. Andrea O'Reilly is a full professor in the School of Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies at York University in Canada. In 1997, she broke new ground in her field with a project called the Motherhood Initiative. She demonstrated the academic viability of this topic, publishing many scholarly periodicals, anthologies, and books, and hosting many conferences around the world. I'm Frieda Werton. In 2011, I interviewed Dr. O'Reilly about how and why she established Motherhood Studies.
Can we talk about some of the organizations that are applying, what do you call it, mothering theory?
Or? Yes, I mean, in the book, The 21st Century Motherhood Movement, Mothers Speak Out on Why We Need to Change the World and How to Do It, and basically making the point that we need a feminism that is mother-centered. I coined the term, for better or for worse, matricentric feminism. Not ever to imply to replace, you know, mainstream feminism in its various configurations, but I do believe that women are oppressed in patriarchal cultures. They're oppressed as women, but they're also oppressed in ways quite unique to them being a mother. And so sort of identify what that specific oppression looks like if you're a mother, but as importantly, to also think about how mothering can be a place of power for mothers. And I think in our culture, and Adrienne Rich talks about this at length in her book of Woman Born, the irony, or more appropriately, the tragedy, is that the very thing, for lack of a better word, that gave women historically power was their motherhood identity. But that very thing now has been misused and used against them. So it's about reclaiming the maternal power that has been taken from us, but taking it back in such a way that empowers us and the work we must do as mothers, right?
Well, yeah, it is very strange, actually, that sort of the judo that was performed on feminism was that women got the right to work, but also we lost because wages fell. Mm-hmm. Now two parents have to work to make as much as proportionally as one parent used to be able to make. So we haven't made any gains there, but we've lost the ability to spend, of either parent, to spend as much time with the children.
Right. And again, this is not feminism fault at all, but I do think we live in a culture, and any mother or any thinking person would agree, that completely, you know, devalues mother work. They don't see it as work. Well, it's not work. It's not pay. We live in a culture, of course, that value is determined by monetary measures. And because mothers are not paid for the work they do, they're not seen as working. And I think that's gotten worse over the years. And we've become increasingly in a neoliberal world, in a material world, that worth is even being more determined by your paycheck than I would say 20, 30, 40 years ago. And to compound that, as you said, now households require two incomes. And the thing that troubles me is that I do think for some women, there have been huge gains since the rise of feminism. I mean, largely privileged, you know, middle class, white, able-bodied women, that if you can live as unencumbered and disembodied and talk and walk like the boys, then you can really benefit from patriarchy. If yes, of course, not completely. We still have violence against women. We still have battering, of course. But I think when you become a mother, motherhood is encumbered and it's embodied. And in our culture, only, you know, those who do not have that can compete as so-called equals with men. And the reality is that women still do the majority of childcare, home care, domestic labor, and I also call it community care. They're the ones who, you know, keep the neighborhoods running. I also call it like emotional care. They're the ones who make sure, you know, an aunt Sally falls down and breaks her leg, that flowers are delivered to the hospital and somebody makes soup for when she comes home. So women, you know, have a first, second, third, and arguably fourth shift. And that hasn't changed. So that, for me, that's people always say that feminism you know, feminism has stalled and why, and a lot of people have said it's because of motherhood, that motherhood is the unfinished business of feminism. I think it's partially true, but I think the unfinished business of feminism is men, right? That's where we need to make social change. You know, we have to redefine mothering as a social good, as something that has to, it's required and all have to do it. So now women today, yes, they have to behave as unencumbered, individualistic citizens in the workforce and then come home and do all the encumbered work of maternal care. And men get off the hook, you know?
Well, I do think that in the last decade or two that the younger fathers mm-hmm. seem to be assuming more of the parenting obligations and the pleasures
yes.
of parenting.
I think so. And I always joke to my students, in my days of despair, I need to remember that. But I still think what's happening, and I don't think I'm alone in this, I draw really from Sarah Ruddick's work here. I think that women, though, are still doing the psychological work of mothering, the emotional work, what Sarah Ruddick calls maternal thinking. They're the ones remembering, planning, organizing, anticipating, you know. So I always say if the, you know, the woman has to remind her partner to get the bag of milk on the way home, delegation does not equality make. And I think a lot of households, men are doing a lot of FaceTime. They're at the park with their child. But the woman is still keeping the household in her head. Who has to go to the doctor's appointments, you know, or, you know, their daughter, 12, is not eating. Oh, do we need to be worried? Is she suffering from anorexia? I mean, kind of keeping all that going on, that men, and I've done a fair bit of research on this, and as has Andrew Doucette from here in Ottawa, that men really don't do that emotional, intellectual work of mothering. They put in the FaceTime, but I think that's what most women say is exhausting about mothering, particularly when it's combined with paid work, because it's completely unbounded. You know, it's a job that never ends, mothering. So you're lying in bed at 3 o'clock in the morning, worried about your child or planning an event. And that type of stuff, I think, is what's catching up and causing a lot of burnout with women. It's not so much the work, though that's hard, but that kind of intellectual, you know, holding the household in your head, that can't be downloaded. And I don't think men are sharing equally in that sort of maternal thinking. And that part, until there's truly that shared intellectual labor of raising children, I think we're going to still be stuck.
Well, how do you think that that might be brought about?
I think by doing it. I mean, I really believe that mothering, there's nothing natural about mothering. I don't think there's anything inherent. I was a young mother, unplanned, 22. Somebody asked me a baby, and I said, you got to be kidding me. I had never held a baby. I didn't know anything about mothering. And I thought it was a joke. I said, you're letting me take this 8-pound baby home. I became a good mother by doing it. And I didn't have my mother near me. She lived in another city. I learned the hard way. I wouldn't advise that either. Completely on my own, isolated. But I learned. And you see this often with men who have full custody or men who are widowed. They become completely competent doing that stuff I'm talking about, that maternal labor, intellectual labor, because they have to. And I always say to my students, I say, my advice is have men involved from day one. And have them involved in such a way where the woman is completely absent. Like I say to my students, you need to go away for a week, maybe ideally two, and you don't do anything. You don't prepare the meals. You don't iron and lay the clothes out. You don't organize the kids' schedules. You walk out. And you know what? By the second or third day, and he can't call his mother either, though. That's also the part of it. He can't, you know, he has to do it. And, you know, I know many men who are completely involve equal parents because they're doing that real work, not just the fun stuff on Saturday afternoon, the FaceTime. So I really think that men are as competent parents as women, but they just don't have to, because, you know, women are telling them how to do it and, you know, where to do it. And I think if you just step back, men will figure it out like every woman on the earth has figured it out.
Right. Now, what about the larger society and the way all the resources are being pulled out from under most families, so that mothering becomes sacrificial, you might say. Mm-hmm. Are you going to eat, or are your child going to eat? You know, these things.
Oh, I completely agree. I mean, I write about this and talk about this in my teaching, and Demeter Press will be publishing a book on this. I believe that neoliberalism, the rise of neoliberalism, has probably been the death knell for mothers, because there's been just a complete removal of any type of, you know, societal, governmental support, complete emphasis on individualism and, you know, self-reliance, and everything's been downloaded to the family. It's now your own fault and your own responsibility. And I do think that's a huge problem. And I think we're going to realize it even more in retrospect. I think we're going to look back and go, oh gosh, you know, we can see it happening in the 80s and 90s. I do believe we're in a crisis situation with families because they are completely unsupported. And absolutely, I mean, mothers need support to raise children well, and families need support to raise children well. And it just puzzles me and frustrates me that they don't get that. It, you know, they're always say we love children and children are our future and they're going to pay our pensions and all this empty rhetoric. But they don't support families to raise the children that they supposedly, you know.
What kind of support would government ideally or perhaps in a normal society offer?
Yes, well, I think we have certainly models. That, for example, we can look at Quebec. I mean, their child care program has been hugely successful. Yes, I've heard criticisms of it and justified ones, but quite on the micro level. I read in the Toronto Star just last week or 2 weeks ago a large report, and I want to see the whole report, this was just a summary of it, that it has paid for itself. It, because of the increased wages of those working women who are now back in the paid labor force, who are paying income tax. And according to their books, it is a self-sustaining program now. So absolutely childcare, you know, good funded, non-profit childcare. Also definitely, as I said earlier, though I'm a bit ambivalent about maternity leaves, I think we have to have extended parental leaves. And certainly public and social policy that recognizes care work as a social good. So whether that be sick leave for family, I don't even like the term sick leave, I like sort of family leave or whatever you want to call it, personal days, that we are not just workers, we're human beings. And I think everybody should have a personal day or two a month. And if that means taking your car in to be fixed or taking your pet to the vet or taking your child to the dentist, you know, we are human beings and we have to run our lives and we have to understand that. And I think in the past we were able to do it because we had wives doing it. Men had wives to pick up their dry cleaning or, you know, do whatever. These wives are now working in the paid labor force. So all this work of running households is just now hanging in limbo, but it still needs to be done. You know, so I do think we have to understand that family work, childcare is not a private individual thing. It's part of the larger social fabric. So even just a change in perspective, then I hope would change policy.
Well, let's talk about the effect of motherhood studies. Mm. As something that may eventually change policy.
Mm-hmm.
How did motherhood studies get started, mm-hmm. and what is it like now?
Yes, I mean, we started using, I mean, I actually coined, I think in 2006, the term motherhood studies, and maybe it should have been mothering studies or maternal studies, but that name seems to have stuck, motherhood studies. Basically, I really see motherhood studies as very parallel to women's studies. There was a recognition of an absence. So with women's studies in the 60s and 70s, women were not being included in your history course or your sociology course or what have you. And women recognized that to make that happen, they had to, you know, create a discipline of their own. Certainly when I began my work in motherhood in the 90s, early 90s, I actually did a quite involved analysis of curriculum here in Canada, a little bit in the States, and motherhood was not on women's studies curriculum. I mean, it was quite alarming, and what was even more alarming, they didn't even realize it wasn't there.
I think that probably relates to the absence of motherhood from the entire
exactly.
academy.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I'm doing a research project now, a Shirk-funded one. I've just finished my interviews. I interviewed 70 mother academics across North America, and I had my children, you know, 20 to 25 years ago, and things are not better. The academy is so hostile to mothers. It's more hostile than any other profession. Academics have fewer children than architects, doctors, lawyers. It's quite alarming, actually. And so there's been a lot of thinking about why that's so. But yeah, motherhood was completely invisible. So the people who are creating new knowledge, researchers, teachers, were not mothers. So understandably, they didn't include it on their curriculum. So an average intro to women's studies course would have violence and education and sexuality and work, all important topics. But you wouldn't find motherhood.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't see the M word mentioned in a women's studies class. Now that has changed somewhat, not as much as I'd like to, but I do believe it's become an independent field. And sort of like women's studies has its own, you know, body of knowledge, traditions like must-read theorists or canon of, you know, the thoughts, and they have debates and they have different perspectives, just like women's studies does. So I think it's been around maybe 10 or 15 years now. Then we can see it as an autonomous interdisciplinary discipline, very similar to women's studies.
Who would you say are the must-read theorists in motherhood studies?
Oh, the must-reads? I would definitely say Adrienne Rich, who I believe is the mother of motherhood studies, who published A Woman Born in 76. Sarah Reddick, most definitely, who unfortunately passed away last March. Her concept of maternal thinking. Earlier, African-American, for example, Patricia Hill Collins would be a must-read. More contemporary, Fiona Green, who's here in, at the conference here. She's a Canadian scholar of mine. I do think it's a growing field, so I actually published a book 3 years ago called Maternal Theories, The Essential Readings. And it basically has 50 chapters. And I say to somebody, if you want to know what motherhood studies is, this is the book to dip from. So Mary O'Brien, for example, is in it as a Canadian contributor. And it just basically goes from 1976 to contemporary. Ariel Gore, for example, did stuff on Hip Mama, is in it. And a fair number of queer and lesbian, Catherine Arnip, for example, here in Canada. So I tried to make it as much Canadian and American, and to cover, you know, 30 years of maternal theory from different perspectives.
Is motherhood studies actually making inroads into universities? Are they making spaces for motherhood studies? Is it mostly in the women's studies departments, or how is it manifesting in academies?
I think there are sort of these kind of interesting independent courses. We're publishing in July, this month, I guess, the third edition of a booklet we do called Teaching Motherhood. And it's a collection of syllabi on motherhood, or reproduction more generally. And we actually have courses that are from anthropology, I don't want to say zoology, but anthropology to women's studies. And yes, it's in all the disciplines, you know, psychology, anthropology, history, health, obviously social work, poli-sci. So there are kind of these clustering of courses in our syllabi. I think we have 50, so not a lot, but that's still not bad. I mean, these are just sending out on email. If you teach a course, send it to us. So they seem to be housed in different places. I don't think they're more in women's studies than not. In fact, I think there may be still less in women's studies. Most of motherhood studies courses are coming from other disciplines. So they'll have a motherhood studies course in anthropology. Right? I actually gave a talk in January of this year. I went down to a university in the States, and it was sort of an anthropology course that was a special topic one, you know, fourth year seminar, and the special topic for that year was motherhood. So they seem to come under the special topics, you know, in literature or something, you know, they'll have special topics, mothering literature. So I think it's still interdisciplinary. I don't really think it's based yet in any discipline, and I would say less so in women's studies. Women's studies has a very ambivalent relationship with motherhood. And I think it's getting better, but it's still fraught with tension.
Yeah, I think that the women's studies often feels that they're just clinging to legitimacy by their toenails.
Yes.
And that the patriarchy is breathing down their neck.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think, understandably, there is nervousness because motherhood, and what I talked about in my talk today, you know, I think the distinction between motherhood, which Rich theorized as oppressive, patriarchal, understandably, feminists wanted no part of that. But I think what happened is, I use the expression, threw the baby out with the bathwater. It's not mothering that's the problem. It's how we're expected and told and regulated to mother. But I get that. In the early 70s, motherhood was oppressive, as it was represented and lived by most women. So there's a real nervousness. And the other thing, too, that I think there's such nervousness around what we call essentialism in women's studies. We want to see gender as constructed. We want to ignore the body. And very nervous about any claims that women are indifferent, because that's suicide, right, for women's studies scholars. That's what's been used against women forever. And so I think there's a real dancing around motherhood because it's seen as always oppressive, which I don't believe it is, and it's seen as essentialist, which I don't think it is. But I see how women's studies professors get very nervous how that could so quickly be turned against and used against them. That there's all, and I may add that majority of women's studies professors aren't mothers. I mean, that's just the way it is. Now, there are some, but there are fewer women's studies professors that are mothers than other disciplines, in my experience of interviewing. I mean, you'll find more mothers in history or in sociology than you'll find in women's studies. I don't know why that is. I mean, I think part of it is feminism. But it's interesting. And I'm not saying women's studies, certainly in my experience, my department has not been hostile to me at all. They've been hugely supportive. But I've heard other women's studies scholars have had less than reception to the work they do. They keep it in the closet. They don't talk about their motherhood research.
Well, in your talk, you were talking about some of the criticisms of arguments about motherhood.
Mm-hmm.
You said emotionalism was one, essentialism was one.
Yes.
You just talked about. You want to just mention what the other ones were?
Well, yeah, I think emotionalism is an important one, too. I mean, it ties in with the other ones because motherhood activists have often used emotive strategies. And the criticism is coming from feminists and others, but feminists, early feminists, and early, I mean, early 2000, because the motherhood movement's only been around for maybe, I mean, in an organized way, you know, 5-6 years, you know, so it's very, very new. So we can't really talk about it because it's still forming. But early criticism of the motherhood movement was that it relied on emotion for the strategies. And they saw that as irrational and, you know, unpredictable, and they called it, you know, politics of grief. It's a club nobody wants to belong to, i.e., you know, mothers against gang violence who've lost their children to gang violence. And that's what I probably take the most offense to, because all activism is motivated by the personal and the emotional. Of course it is. That's why you become an activist, right? Because something in your life has angered you or your child or your partner. And I just find it so interesting that only motherhood organizations have been brought to task for their emotionalism and they're too personal. And yet the civil rights movement, environmental movement, peace movement, they've all been founded on feelings and thought, you know, as much as thoughts. So this critique of emotionalism has really been quite devastating to the motherhood movement. You know, they want to be prepared rational and orderly and composed. And so, and I don't think so. I think the organizations in my book have demonstrated that a lot of this emotionalism, yes, is felt, but it's also very deployed strategically. You know, they use it strategically to get attention, to get an audience, to get sympathy, and then they got them where they want them, and then they become these, you know, the more militant activists. The other criticism is embodiment, that maternal activists have really often positioned their protests or strategies through the body. So the example I gave in my talk, for example, the Argentinian mothers, when they were protesting the dictatorship, you know, they would wear placards, life-size, of their children's on their bodies, right? Marking their memory, like their children could not be forgotten. The mothers acting up are quite flamboyant, performative group, and when they march, they come out on stilts, and they dress up, and they, you know, very colorful, very performative. Likewise, code pink. Whenever they're the peace activist group mother, they only wear pink, and they come out with pink boas, and they deliberately, you know, inscribe their body so that they can't be ignored, right? So they're very visible. And if you're coming out on stilts in a march, somebody's going to pay attention to you, right? You're very visible. So a lot of these organizations, you know, they don't deny the body. In fact, the activism is expressed in and through the body, both through marches and, as I said, sort of these very embodied forms of protest.
And your own solution to that was somehow to combine everything?
Yes. Whatever works, works. There's a multitude of strategies to draw from other activists. And so if you have to play a good mother, if that's what you have to do, you do it. I mean, you don't believe it, but you do it to get the media interview or to get the appointment with the politician that you wish to speak to. So I say that women often play normative motherhood. Oh, I'm a mother, please listen, I just love my child. Well, yes, that's all true, but they're doing it, I think, very strategically to get the audience, to get the attention, to get the media attention in particular. Like the mothers of Argentina said, nobody's going to run a mother down with a tank. They're not going to. And so people say, well, that's co-opting, and well, if it works, it works. And these women they were very political. They might have acted like good, pious mothers, but they didn't stop there. You know, they were extremely radical and militant and public. So I do think that mothers are really redefining activism. It's both private and public. It's both rational and irrational. It's sort of both, you know, intellectual and embodied. And I think that they're really defining the meaning of activism. And I think they're making it a lot more joyful, too. I think there's a lot of, I don't want to say fun, because a lot of these are very sad organizations that have, you know, lost children to gun violence or police brutality. But they're doing it very I think often very much like third wave feminism, in a very performative, very public way that is more, I don't know, I can only say colorful, that they're really claiming space. They're not, you know, they're in a way that's very, I keep saying performative, just that they're...
And maybe you could say expressive.
Expressive, yes.
Because you can express yourself, yes. That's fun.
Yes, exactly, yes. It's expressive. And they can do it in all these kind of really crazy, playful, ironic ways. And I think it's neat. Like, the example I always use, and I know there's a lot of controversy around slut walk, but I think slut walk has been one who's embraced that kind of performative, in-your-face, expressive, we're going to play with concepts. And I think the motherhood movement is quite similar to the slut walk. They're kind of using tropes and then reinventing the word, right? Saying, okay, yeah, I'm so-called a good housewife. Well, just watch me, right? I think deconstructive strategies.
I have to say that I think that was what was so fun about the women's liberation movement in the 70s, too, that maybe this has always been the strength of the women's movement.
Yeah. Every feminist I know has a great sense of humor. We're all fun. We play hard. We work hard. But there's this really negative view of feminists of being angry and, well, we are angry. But there's this real negative, and I think I don't know where that comes from. Because every feminist organization rally event I've been to, it's been a blast, right? So I don't know where this stereotype has come. So I say to my students, what are you talking about? Have you ever been to any of these events? Well, no. And I said, well, how do you know then that they're these strict, you know, serious... I mean, yes, of course, some of them are when we're dealing with very tragic things. But I think even then, there's a sense of camaraderie and joy among the women. One woman who's in the organization, she started an organization, Mothers Against Trafficking in Humans, and lost her child to human trafficking. And obviously, you can imagine how tearful her talk would be. But I've never met a woman who has such a sense of humor and such joy and such passion that you're listening to her and you're crying, but you're simultaneously laughing. That her ability to take tragedy and try to use it in a transformative way. And I think that's what a lot of these motherhood organizations do.
Well, I think this is the most radical thing that I've seen in a very long time, the motherhood movement. I think it gets right to the core of the anti-human trends. And how they must be stopped.
Right, and I was interviewed earlier today, and I mentioned in my talk as well, what frustrates me probably more than anything is the view that motherhood is apolitical, that when you become a mother, somehow you've sold out, gone over, you're not a political person anymore. And I think, where did that come from? Motherhood is the most political place it can be, both in the way we raise our children. I'm very proud to say I have three feminist children, all in their 20s, I think my best accomplishment. You know, I'm very proud to say that both women's studies major. My son's off to start his PhD at McGill in human trafficking. So I'm like, wow, I can say that's I've done well. I mean, I don't take all the credit by any means, but I think we can really raise a different generation of children. But also, even through our mothering, we can find power as our women. Because so many mothers have told me it's when they became a mother that they felt for the first time in charge, angry. You know, I'm not taking this anymore. And I don't know what it is. Like, I do know, but I think it's complex that motherhood really radicalizes women and politicizes women, or at least it can. And I think it's really a place where we can, you know, make change. I'm not saying the others aren't as good, but I do think it's untapped. There's globally over 80% of women become mothers. And we don't have 80% of feminists, okay, unfortunately, in the world. So if we can use motherhood, make all mothers feminists, then we can change the world.
So if anybody can, you can. Oh, Andrea O'Reilly, thank you so much.
All right, thank you so much. Thank you.
Okay.
Andrea O'Reilly is the founder of Mercy, the Motherhood Initiative for Research and Community Involvement. She publishes Motherhood Scholarship through Demeter Press. To hear this program again, email wings@wings.org. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose scholarship posits mothering as the paradigm of the gift economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. I'm Frieda Werden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.